The chill in the air and the color on the trees are sure signs of fall, but so are the large number of raccoons and possums you see along the roadside. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. This hour, we'll do the fall shuffle and find out why so many critters are on the move this time of year. Raccoons and possums are moving around. Deer are getting a little careless. Some birds are disappearing from feeders, and others are showing up on lakes and rivers. We'd also love to hear about the changes that you're seeing in your neck of the woods. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. There's a chill in the air, color creeping onto the trees, and critters are on the move. And with me today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Hello, Jim.
Good morning. We've got to move it.
I don't need a soundtrack with
you.
But this is a program that is inspired mainly by roadkill, right?
Yeah, in a sense, that's true. If people have been at all observant on their drive to work or home from work or over the weekend, you might have noticed over the past 2 to 3 weeks especially, there have been lots and lots of roadkill. And especially, it seems that possums and raccoons are biting the dust. And increasingly now, I'm noticing lots of deer on the sides of the roads, both dead and alive. This is the time of year to change your driving habits. If you haven't done so already, slow down, and especially in the early morning and the evening, watch the ditches in addition to the road ahead. Watch the ditches ahead on either side, because lots of critters are moving around. It's that time of year.
And why? Why are they on the move? Particularly, let's start with raccoons. Where are they going?
Yeah, well, nobody knows. they're about. It turns out the studies show that about 40% of a raccoon population in the fall of the year will move around. And they're moving for lots of reasons. Often they're young males that have been they're in search of new territory to spread out into. They're getting sort of thrown out, if you will, by their parents saying it's time for you to be on your own. Go away to college. Go someplace. You know, and so they may switch locations by hundreds of yards to many miles away. There are estimates, or not estimates, but there are observations of raccoons moving 10, 15 miles away from their natal home. You would think that they would move up and down rivers, and indeed they do. But Iowa has this incredible network of roads. We have over 89,000 miles of just secondary roads. Now, that doesn't include the primary highways, just secondary roads, 89,000 miles. I think we're top in the nation for miles of road per capita or something. And it's really, that means that even though they may be using river corridors and stream corridors, they're invariably going to come to have to cross a road someplace. And they often, as a result, get hit on the side.
And with different species, there are different patterns of how the animals move away from their parents, their mothers, usually.
Right.
And in some species, the females move off and they create their own territory. In some species, it's the males. Do we know in raccoons?
In raccoons, it seems to be both, but males in particular are prone, young males in particular are prone to move, but certainly young females as well. They have to have places not just to overwinter, but to establish a new territory. Now, in raccoons, it is, you would think there'd be lots of open territory, and there often is, because they are subject to distemper over the winter months, in the fall and into the winter, and so their populations are often, quite reduced very heavily by distemper in the fall and early winter. So you'd think there'd be lots of open territories, but In fact, they're still searching for, you know, the ones this fall are searching for areas to overwinter in. So they're hunting for den sites. They're hunting for places to spend the winter. These are not hibernators, so they have to have an area that they're able to get out occasionally and eat, and find finding a good food source is certainly primary. They do go into long periods of sleep, so they may be looking for places to den up, especially during storms or periods of really bad weather, that severe cold, that sort of thing. They'll den up for quite some time and live off their fat reserves. But young raccoons often don't have that. So they're in search of food, they're in search of denning places, and they're in search of territory.
And when they're looking for those places where they can den up, what kinds of places are they looking for?
Well, ideally, you would think that they'd be looking for a hollow tree.
That's what we learned in children's books, yes.
That's right. But they take advantage of they're very adaptable critters. They're a lot like us, and they can adapt to lots of things. They're pretty flexible in their fulfilling their needs. So sometimes they'll tear up some shingles to live in your attic. They'll live underneath a garden shed. They love these elevated porches, decks that we seem to put on the back of our houses and don't protect with any kind of fencing. So they'll take up residence under there. Sometimes window wells that are particularly well covered, they'll spend some time in there. So the human habitation is just as good if they have a way of getting in or getting under. They will certainly use that as well. So it's not just hollow trees that they're looking for. They'll also live in cities. They'll live down in storm sewers. They will take up residence in some of the finest neighborhoods in cities where their sewage system, and I did a study on this when I was a senior in college in the city of Madison, Wisconsin. There was the raccoons were living in one of the older parts of town where the sanitary sewer and the storm sewers were the same system. So they would live in the better end of town because everybody there had garbage disposals. And
so much to eat.
Yes, exactly. Came right down the tube. You know, hey, this is great. You know, it's a feeder.
So. I don't even have to chew.
That's right. Wonderful. That's right.
Well, recently I have met in just totally different circumstances, a number of different people who are frightened of raccoons. And of course, Jim, as you know, I grew up in a family of wildlife rehabilitators, and many of my closest friends were raccoons when I was a child. So,
sure.
So that surprised me. But a lot of people do seem to be frightened of them.
Yeah, I'm not sure why that is. It's certainly, under normal circumstances, I don't encourage people to handle any wild, truly wild animal. And if an animal appears to approach you, you should go the opposite direction because they're going to defend themselves, or they may be defending young. Or, in fact, in the case of raccoons, sometimes they may be sick. Distemper is a particularly debilitating. We've talked about that sometime this past year in the program. We talked about wildlife diseases, and distemper tends to make them they have myopia. They can't see very far. They tend to be kind of dizzy and glassy-eyed. And hips sometimes don't operate well, so that they're sort of walking sideways or around in circles, and they're often out in daytime. And so if there's a nocturnal animal, a normally nocturnal animal, like a raccoon that is around in the daytime, you probably should stay away from it. Chances are pretty good that it's not well. But outright fear of them seems, kind of too bad, and I think it denotes that they're not understanding the critter or have much knowledge about them, perhaps.
Well, let's talk about another animal that a lot of people react to with fear and that we have been seeing on the roadsides. Let's talk a little bit about the possum.
Yeah, possums are they're just fascinating. And they are doing the same thing, although the studies of possums are not as as many as raccoons. Certainly possums move around in the fall. They do this fall shuffle. It's a new dance. You know, you should try that. they do this fall shuffle as they move around, hunting for territory. Same sorts of things that raccoons are. They're hunting for a place to overwinter, a place to find food, and a place to find open territory. And it's often the young ones that are now essentially teenagers striking out on their own, and they don't know roads very well, and they get hit on the side of the road. Now, the thing that's really interesting about possums, of course, is that they have this physiological reaction where they, quote-unquote, play possum. So sometimes if they're lying in the middle of the road, you wonder if they're playing possum or not, but, right. But usually they're not. Because they're a marsupial, they appear not to be subject at all to rabies, which is a nice thing about them. But they've got this fierce growl. If you encounter one as you open your garbage can or leave your garbage can open and a possum is in there in the morning, they'll growl at you and glare at you and show their teeth and then often sort of faint and go into this this playing possum routine. So it's quite a sight.
And they don't tend to be very they're not aggressive in that they will just stay there.
Yeah, yeah. They're not warm and cuddly though.
No.
have you had experience in raising young possums?
Yes, many times. And they are lovely little creatures. They don't, to anthropomorphize, they don't strike you as intelligent.
Right.
They're very
right.
simple creatures.
Very simple.
And they smell terrible.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But they're one of the people that we used to work with doing wildlife rehabilitation was the director of the Humane Society in Waterloo, Iowa for a while. And he's now in Des Moines. But he was asked by one of his employees once, so would a possum bite you? And he said, well, I think it would if you stuck your finger in its mouth.
Yeah, that's...
And then, of course, the employee came in about a half hour later. He said, you're right. But that's really the only circumstance that I can imagine a possum actually biting you in, or even unless you tried to reach out and pick it up without gloves.
Right, right. And they'll growl, and it usually works. People back right off if they're growling and snarling and showing their teeth. And but as you say, they're not jumping out at you growling like dogs or raccoons sometimes do. So, yeah, it's but they're being killed on the roads because they're in this fall shuffle, just as raccoons are. Now, this happened with another species a little bit earlier. In August, people may have noted, I'm one of these people that drives around and I check out the roadkill wherever I drive, you know, oh, what was that, you know? And so I notice these things, and I'm not sure that everyone probably does that, but woodchucks in August were being cast out by their mothers, and they were frequently being killed on the roads in August.
Well, we're going to take a short break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's an environmental interpretive and a wildlife consultant based in Ames. You're welcome to join our conversation with your observations of the changes that you're seeing in your neck of the woods right now. Animals on the move. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. And of course, Jim will answer your questions as well. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, my guest is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about the fall shuffle. A lot of animals on the move this time of year. And Jim, we were talking about raccoons, possums, woodchucks did this a little bit earlier in the summer, in August. But you were talking about seeing quite a few deer out and about. What's going on with deer right now?
Well, of course, deer are moving into the period of year that we call the rut. And what that means is that they have basically one thing on their minds. That is sex. And they want to, this is the breeding season, the beginning of the breeding season for deer. It will peak in about 2 to 3 weeks from now, or early November. The first week of November is usually the peak of the rutting season. But as a result, they tend not to eat as much. They tend not to pay as much attention to cars on the road. They're paying attention to each other. The bucks are running around. The does are in estrus, so they give off a pheromone, a smell, and the bucks are in search of that. And when they find it, they will chase that doe around for quite some time, and in order to breed. So they breed in the fall of the year, and as a result of that breeding season, they are very susceptible to being hit by cars. Again, owing to the large number of miles of roads we have, this grid network, this one-mile grid of particularly secondary roads in the state. But in addition, they're certainly along the major highways. And if you're traveling along at 70 miles an hour on an interstate and a deer comes out in front of you, you have very little chance of stopping. So you need to drive very, very defensively, especially in the evening and the morning, but at all times, actually, at this time of year, because they're not looking for you. They're looking for each other, and it is no fun to hit a deer for either you or the deer, and so it's and I'm already seeing a number of them dead on the road. They're also changing. While the males will go great distances in the fall of the year, the females are also sometimes moving around because their summer range. Home range is not always the same as their winter home range. They need different kinds of things. In the summer, of course, they're eating lots of herbaceous plants. Deer have been known to eat over 350 different species of plants. So they're a generalist. They can eat lots and lots of different things. There are things they prefer and things they don't prefer, but given enough hunger, they'll eat just about anything in the landscape, with very few exceptions. And so they're in the wintertime, they're looking for stable winter browse supplies. You've noticed, of course, that the leaves are changing. That means that not only is the color going out of them, but the nutrition is going out of them as well. And so they begin to transition in the fall of the year. In fact, their whole stomach flora, the bacteria in their rumen, has to change as well to be able to digest woody plants instead of those juicy summer plants and herbaceous plants. So they'll often, to find a proper, a good supply of winter forage, they'll often change locations. So they're changing because of the rutting season, but also because they're moving to their winter home range.
Now, of course, a lot of people love to watch the fawns that live in their neighborhood during the summer, started out as little spotted tiny things, and then grow. During this time of the year, are they still with their mothers, or are they going out on their own more and more?
Well, some of both. And because there is a range of birthing dates, because the rutting season lasts for from now, essentially, through the middle of November, you may have some does that come into very late estrus and will have fawns much later in the summer. June is not unusual anymore, sometimes late June. I had a report just this week of someone seeing a very small fawn still spotted. Now, that's a very, very late deer. So, yes, some of them are still, in fact, some of the late spring, early summer fawns are still on milk with their mothers. So it wouldn't be unusual at all to see them together. Doesn't mean, however, that she can't come into estrus. She will still come into estrus, and perhaps late, and still be bred yet this fall.
We talked about all the flooding back in June when it was wet here in the state of Iowa. Different environment back then. And we talked about the fact that a lot of fawns were getting separated from their mothers.
Right.
There were other animals that were being impacted. Do you think we're going to see a lower deer population this fall?
Yeah, I do. I think for a number of reasons. One is that the DNR has been working very hard to reduce the deer herd, and that has been successful. When you look at states around us, Minnesota and Wisconsin, they have such a hunting community has such an orientation towards large bucks there that it's difficult to get them to take dose, but that is not true in Iowa. And so they very successfully removed a lot of dose from the population and brought the population down. Now, I'm sure there are listeners out there who say, well, not in my area, and that may be true in some small areas, but I would say statewide, the deer herd is down considerably from what it was. And I think that the weather certainly impacted. The weather we had this year in the spring in May and June with the torrential rains over certain watersheds, I noticed many fewer does that I saw this summer had twins with them. There were still some, but usually we have a large a doe over the age of after her first doe. The first time a doe has a fawn, they usually have a single. But in Iowa, once they're beyond that first year, they usually have twins, and triplets are in somewhere between 10% and 12% of them. Because we have very good nutrition here, they eat a lot of waste corn and beans during the fall and winter if it's available, if it's not plowed under, and certainly in the summer they've got excellent nutrition with lots of cropland available as well. So they tend to have more young than deer in some other states that don't have the agricultural crops to depend on.
We also talked this spring with all of the water about nests on the ground and how they may have been impacted by the cold temperatures and the floods.
Yeah.
Are we going to see an impact in, say, pheasant populations this fall?
Oh, definitely. Pheasant populations, now they, you have to understand how they count pheasant populations and estimate what the harvest is going to be. They drive over. There are regular routes that are called pheasant routes that are driven in early August. They're 30-mile, approximately 30-mile routes that they will drive, and in the early morning. And in the early morning, pheasants are often in August. Pheasants are often out on the roadside because of the heavy dews that are usually around in August. And they'll look at the pheasants that are out on the road, count those. How many hens, how many roosters, and how many, you can't tell because they're still too young. And then they'll base that. It's an index to the pheasant population. It's not an exact count, certainly, but it's an index to the population when you compare them across many years of doing this, which is what they do. And it looks like this year, from those August counts, that the pheasant population is, while it came up last year a little bit because we had a not-so-bad winter and a pretty decent spring, but this year with all the wetness, pheasant populations are well below last year's population, which was already low. So, yeah, pheasant populations, any ground-nesting bird populations that were nesting in May and June were certainly impacted on a statewide basis, and pheasants, quail, that sort of thing would all be impacted this fall.
I'm talking with wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about all of the changes taking place in wildlife populations right now in the fall of the year. And he is willing to answer your questions as well. We'd love to know about the changes you're seeing where you are. And, of course, take your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Jim, Marion called from the Quad Cities, and this is a woman after your own heart. She just left us this. She says, why did the chicken cross the road to prove to the raccoon and the possum that it could be done. I knew you'd love that.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, let's go to
the
phones.
We can use that on the joke show.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones. Reno is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Reno.
Hi. I walk by this pond all the time at work, and I've been following all spring and summer long these two ducks that get there by themselves, and they just hung around together all the time. And then one day, I saw the duck was crying, and I didn't know what was going on. And then the next guy came by, and it was right by its dead partner.
Oh, really?
It was ran over by a lawnmower. These guys go crazy on these lawnmowers at these complexes. It really hurt. I'm not kidding you.
Yeah.
And my concern is, And the duck's by himself all the time, of course, and then the geese will be around. They don't pick on him or nothing, but I'm just wondering what's going to happen. Is he going to stay there and freeze, or is he going to have enough sense to get up and fly away?
Well, it depends on I think you've got your radio on, right? There we go. Okay. I think it depends on whether it's a domesticated duck or whether it is a wild duck that came in there. And certainly wild ducks, as they begin to migrate, and they're already beginning, although it's just at the sort of the beginning of the northern flocks haven't come down yet, but we've certainly had blue-winged teal, and some mallards are moving around now. Wood ducks certainly are pretty much gone. But the big migration of ducks from the north hasn't come down. And oftentimes, a duck on a pond, whether or not it's lost its partner for that year, will as soon as the flocks start going by, they'll hear them and join them on their way south. On the other hand, if it is a domestic duck, then it will have to either find a place to spend the winter, usually with open water, and it's certainly possible for them to overwinter here in Iowa. There are certainly ducks that do it, as long as the water has as long as there's some open water, and because we have geese doing the same thing that are here year-round now. And, you know, so it may or may not migrate, but it may just move to a spot where there is some open water.
And we do occasionally see domestic ducks and geese living not on a farmstead.
Right, right. Right. Yeah, particularly in urban ponds. You know, I should want to make a note about waterfowl populations because the heavy spring rains across the whole we're in the Mississippi Flyway, and the ducks and geese and other waterfowl that come down through Iowa basically come from the prairie provinces of Canada, including eastern and southeastern Alberta, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Western Ontario. Basically, they sort of funnel down into the Central and Mississippi Flyways, which sort of join into the Mississippi Flyway. And those populations are breeding birds, and they fly routes up there across those provinces. And there are people who specialize. This is kind of interesting. I think that people who specialize in from the air and can count sort of breeding pairs, believe it or not, from the air. They estimate populations from the air, and it's quite an amazing feat to me to be able to do that. But they're trained specially, and practice makes perfect on that. And so their estimates for this year were that we had a tremendous nesting success or nesting of birds, and had very good nesting success. The fall forecast by folks like Ducks Unlimited is that it should be as good or better than the fall flight of ducks, as good or better than last year, which was a sort of a record year. So it looks very good for ducks and geese, at least. But there's a concern, and that concern is particularly in the prairie provinces and in our sort of duck factory that's called in North and South Dakota. Increasing development, and we see this same thing again, not of human habitation, but in development of oil and gas fields in those areas. North Dakota, in particular, is seeing tremendous rapid development of many of our wild areas into oil and gas wells. And increasing pressure from large-scale agricultural interests that want to drain a lot of areas. So it's the same pressures all over again, but so they're concerned about the future in those areas. But across the prairie provinces so far, it looks pretty good.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your call, Reno. And let's go now to Earl on the line in Ames. Hi, Earl.
Hello. I had a question about crows' vocalizations and their mimicry. I was out in the park 2 hours after sundown about 6 weeks ago, a wooded area along the creek, and I heard an owl call out, you know, And then immediately after that, it seemed like an owl calling, caw, 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 caw. And it seemed to be mimicking both the pitch and the cadence of the owl. Now, I know there's hostility between crows and say, right, hawks and owls.
Right.
But I was wondering what was going on there.
Well, it may have indeed been. I've never heard a crow imitate an owl very well. They will certainly, they're very good mimics at some sounds. My father-in-law, who's now gone, but he used to talk about the crow that he had as a child and how good it was at mimicking sounds that he made, not necessarily human words, but various sounds. But I've never heard one. I'm not saying it's impossible by any stretch of the imagination, but I've never heard one actually imitate an owl do it very well. So what you may have is you may have had a barred owl, and they're the ones that go, "Who cooks for you?" And you may have heard that because they are our most diurnal, meaning day dwelling, of our of the three major species in the state: great horns, bards, and screech owls. Bards are the most diurnal, day-dwelling critters. So you'll often hear them hoot in the daytime, and they've been hooting up a storm this fall. They get fooled physiologically by the day length. These barred owls nest in, don't start really nesting until March and in Iowa. And as a result, the day length now is about the same as it is in March, and so they get fooled physiologically. So you may, the crow may have heard that owl hoot and then responded to that hoot as well.
Interesting. Well, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Earl, thank you very much for your call. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. He's an environmental interpretive and wildlife consultant in Ames, and you're welcome to join our conversation. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We've been talking about all the animals on the move this fall, and Earl brought up crows. Are the crows starting to gather in Ames, Jim?
You know, I haven't seen the big groups of them that we'll see later in the winter. We usually have, as you know, Charity, from having lived here, about 10,000 that gather in Ames every year. Yes. And Jim Dinsmore, for many years, did a count with some of his students every year, and it was always turned out to be between 9 and 11,000, so averaged out about 10,000 crows every year. And it's an impressive sort of sight, there are places where you don't want to park your car, certainly, overnight, because the crows will decorate it for you.
It was one of my favorite things about living in Ames.
Oh, it's great. It's really, I think it's a spectacular, as long as you don't have to deal with the mess, I guess. I think it's a really spectacular gathering of crows.
Absolutely. All right, Frank is on the line next in Fremont County. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, last spring, in the fall and spring, I've been seeing quite a few pelicans on burrow pits over along the interstate near the Missouri River.
Sure.
And then yesterday, I was driving along, and here's one on foot crossing the road in front of me, 20 miles from the river, all by his lonesome.
Wow.
Now, is that unusual? Would he possibly have been an injured one, or?
Yeah, I would say that's probably what it was. It was injured pelicans. This another thing that's on the move now. I'm glad you've gotten to watch them, because they're really spectacular here, and getting more and more of them in Iowa. I'm predicting that somewhere down the road we will actually have some nesting on some of our larger lakes, perhaps up in the Okoboji region of Iowa. I think that we'll have some nesting. Right now we just have non-breeding birds for the most part that stick around in the summer, and then we see them in the fall along our waterways, as you said, along the Missouri, along the Mississippi, through central Iowa, along our major reservoirs. We'll see them as well. One of the things that unfortunately happens to them, because they're very large-winged birds, and they'll use the air currents, is that they will run into guy wires of some of the towers that are around, and we'll run into electrical wires that cross rivers in particular. And so I suspect that the one that you saw probably was injured. If you see it again, I would certainly call a local county conservation board, and they can get in touch with wildlife rehabilitators to try and capture it and see if it might be brought back, if it hasn't already been taken by a predator, which is quite possible as well.
Why do you think we'll see nesting pelicans? What would be changing?
Well, the populations are such that I just think that if the habitat is there and they nest on their colonial nesters for the most part, or semi-colonial nesters, and they'll nest on these islands, I just have a feeling that we'll see some. You know, we have so many that are here through the summer months now. Even here in central Iowa, they're hanging around. And these are usually non-breeders, is what they are. They're too young to breed yet. And they may just find as they get older that they, you know, gee, this might be a spot to breed. And they've been hanging around here all summer, so maybe we'll try it this year. And I think that's going to happen. Just as we have with we now have a number of nesting pairs of sandhill cranes in the state that we wouldn't have had even 10 years ago. So it's changing gradually. And as we look at birds that are increasingly around through the summer, I think we can eventually see that they may at least attempt breeding in the area.
We have this email from Jill in Iowa City. She says, this week near hills, I saw a large group of birds flying low. They soared like pelicans, where you can see them for a bit, and then they all turn and sink, and you can't see them anymore.
Yep.
She says, this group was flying in a perfect circle, making a small circle, then shrinking down to an even smaller perfect circle. And she wants to know what species you think it was. She thinks that they were too fast to be pelicans.
I suspect it sounds very much like pelicans because they're a white bird, and as they, particularly in the sunlight, as they turn, they do kind of sort of disappear because the sun isn't shining off of them. But as they come back around again, and what they're doing is they're catching these thermals. Anybody who flies a plane knows that river corridors are sources of tremendous thermals, and you know that if you fly in a small plane and you'll come across a riverbed, and all of a sudden you'll get this uplift suddenly from the river because it's a darker area. And so there's air welling up, warm air welling up out of that river valley. Well, lots of birds take advantage of that, including pelicans and sandhill cranes and herons and all kinds of bird ducks. Both sandhill cranes and pelicans will find those thermals and catch them and go around in circles. It looks like the circles are getting smaller. But it's more that they're getting higher and higher, and then they'll sail down without having to flap a wing. They'll sail down that thermal for 30, 40, 50 miles without having to. So that's how they migrate. They migrate down without with relatively little effort, as opposed to having to flap your wings the whole way.
And, of course, you mentioned they're white. You can see the black tips on their wings, too.
Right.
That's a great way to
exactly.
identify them.
Exactly.
Here's another email. This is from Julie. She says, do those car-mounted deer whistles really work?
The short answer is no. And even though I don't know if the State Patrol still has them on their cars, but they used to. I once did a comparison with Iowa State University vehicles, which are driven not by professional drivers, but by normal everyday folks who are traveling a lot all over the state. And I compared the number of miles that they drove versus the number of miles that the State Patrol drove. And I think the Iowa State, and they'd had no deer whistles and no deer crashes, car deer crashes that previous year. And the State Patrol had deer whistles and had two crashes. And they were roughly equal miles. I can't remember exactly how many miles it was anymore. But the research shows that they simply don't work. And no matter, it doesn't hurt anything to put them on, but it doesn't help anything either. So if you're determined to believe in the myth, then you can put them on. But no, they don't work. In fact, it turns out that the tires on a car usually make a louder noise, and in the range that a deer can hear than any possible deer whistle would. So there have been controlled experiments and lots of papers published on this now that show that, no, they do not work.
Well, and you do hear conflicting advice. Deer often freeze when they hear a strange noise. Do you have advice for how to get a deer to move off the road in front of your car?
Yeah, slow down.
Yes.
And expect them to run in front of your car.
And expect another one to run in front of your car after that.
Right after that, exactly. And so don't think that just because one has passed that the danger is over. Certainly slowing down, putting your flashers on, and pulling over to the side of the road is fine. Try not to stop in the middle of the road, particularly if it's a busy highway, certainly. But do not swerve. In the east, my daughter lives in Vermont. For moose, they do swerve because a moose is taller and can come right through the windshield, of course. But deer, you do not swerve. Just slow down and try and avoid them if you can, but be on the lookout is the main thing to do. And watch them, watch the ditches, watch for eyes, because you do get the eye shine coming back, and slow down is the best thing.
Julie had another question. She said, I recently saw a large snapping turtle on a busy highway. I later saw that it had been hit. Is there a safe way to quickly move a turtle off the roadway? Can you pull it by its tail, or will that hurt it?
It's interesting because I've been with turtle trappers over the years who said, yeah, you just handle them by the tail. But then recently a friend of mine said, no, that actually hurts their spine, which is fused to the shell. So I don't understand why it would hurt the spine. But anyway, so they recommend grabbing them by the front of the shell and the back. I would say with a snapping turtle, I would not risk that. So, yes, pulling them by the tail very gently to the side of the road is probably the safest way and the quickest to get them off.
And if that hurts them, it seems like it would hurt them a lot less than getting run over.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what my thought is, too. So I'm thinking, get them off the road. Now, you know, we do have lots of other things, and I think you talked about this last month. A number of amphibians and reptiles are moving this fall. They're moving it as well. They're moving to places where they can overwinter. And particularly in a dry year like this, they're going to seek wet spots where they can get down in the mud, and turtles, many species of turtles and certainly lots of amphibians will bury themselves down at the bottom of a pond, and their metabolism, because they're ectothermic, they take their temperature from the surrounding, also known as cold-blooded, they seek places where it will be right around or just above freezing, and the mud at the bottom of a pond, usually, unless the pond freezes all the way to the bottom, is a good safe place for them. And their metabolism slows way down so slow that they can absorb the oxygen from the water around them.
All right, Bob is on the line next in Tipton. Hi, Bob.
Hello, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, last year about this time, I had a lot of mice come in the house. So about a few weeks ago, I walked around the foundation, and I saw some animal had started digging along the foundation. So a few days ago, I put a live animal trap there, and this morning, I discovered a skunk in my live animal trap.
Right. So you want to know what to do, huh? Well, you take a blanket or a tarp that you don't care much about, and you approach the cage with the blanket in front of you very slowly and quietly. You don't want to alarm them, and you gently place that tarp over the cage. When it's dark, they feel safe in there. And you can then pick up the cage and move it to either another spot in the yard where you can let the skunk go, or you can put it in the back of a pickup. Don't put it in the trunk of your car, okay?
Or the back seat. That's not a good idea.
Yeah, not a good idea. And then take it to some place where you can release it. And again, you want to do that gently and slowly. They will feel safe as long as it's dark in there. And just no fast movements and lots of noise, or they will spray. But I've had to release a number of skunks, and usually very successfully using this method. So it's not too hard to do, really, if you do it slowly and quietly.
And you'll probably want to discard that blanket or
tarp
later.
Yeah, very likely. Very, very likely.
All right, Bob. Thanks a lot for your call. Karen's on the line next in Story City. Hi, Karen.
Good morning. Great show.
Thank you.
I am calling about honeybees that we have recently had in huge abundance. We left out jelly for the orioles that were migrating and hummingbird feeders, mm-hmm. and the honeybees have just been swarming like crazy. And I guess our question is, are we doing them harm by continuing to put out nectar and jelly for them? Should we stop or continue? Yeah.
Well, first of all, yes, you can stop. The hummingbirds have now left. Central Iowa, they're pretty well gone. If you still have feeders out, you're getting some that are hanging around because of the feeders. So I would go ahead and take those down. The jelly feeders, the orioles are pretty much gone as well. So take those down as well. Chances are it's not just honeybees, but there are also bald-faced hornets, which I know from experience from watching them on my own feeders at home that they look very similar. But I'm also a beekeeper, and I know that, yes, there are lots of honeybees, but there are also lots of hornets as well. So you may have some of both that are feeding on them. This time of year, particularly with the dryness, there was a lot of pollen available, but bees are trying to put up enough, honeybees are trying to put up enough to overwinter, and they were having difficulty finding any flowers that still had nectar in them. There may be some now, prairie flowers along the roadsides, that sort of thing, that are still producing some nectar, but the nectar flow is pretty much over. So when they see a ready source like the hummingbird or jelly oriole feeders, boy, they're right after it.
All right, but she's probably not hurting anything.
No, certainly not. It's not hurting anything. But if what happens is a lot of them drowned in the feeders in trying to get to it. So it's just as well that they go to some other natural sources this time of year.
All right. And our last question of the day, this is an email from Lonnie. I live in West Des Moines by Jordan Creek, just east of I-35. 2 weeks ago, early in the morning, walking down by the railroad tracks, looking out my backyard, was a large dog. How large do coyotes get? She says, or he, I'm sorry, it was probably about 100 pounds compared to my chocolate lab, which weighs about 70.
Yeah, probably was a dog. There are such things as what we call coy dog crosses, and because it's a cross, you often get hybrid vigor, so they get much larger. But my bet is still a dog, Coy dogs are not rare by any means, but they're not all that common, especially in city areas. So my guess would be that it was either a coyote that looking, you know, a large coyote, or a dog that was very wolf-like. Yeah, definitely a coy dog crosses is not out of the question, but it's not all that common.
All right. And that's much larger than a coyote would be.
Right.
And we've been talking about all the changes that we're seeing already. Are there a couple changes coming up in the next few weeks that you're looking forward to in particular?
Yeah, this is the time of year that bats are moving, and we don't see that migration, but they're moving to winter quarters, and they can move north, south, east, west, wherever they can find an area, including your attic, where it might be an overwinter hibernaculum. Usually those go in search of caves, but it has to maintain a temperature just above freezing or right around freezing. But what I'm looking forward to is certainly the very large waterfowl migration. We've already had a lot of birds leave already. Swallows have gone. Warblers are, for the most part, en route. So we're seeing some of the northern warblers coming through right now. But watching the waterfowl populations as they hit our area of lakes, just a magnificent time, and pelicans as well. So it's time of the year to you can observe that diversity of life, so get out there.
All right, Jim, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, with technical support from Jason Burns and Ben Kiefer, host of River to River, is here today. What's coming up?
Hi, Charity. Well, people sometimes confess to a crime they didn't commit, but why? So during the noon hour, we want to look at some new research by two psychologists at Iowa State University that looks at the anatomy of false confessions.
All right, sounds fascinating.
It is.
Coming up at noon on River to River, I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.